If Laurie Hooper has read the book How to Win Friends and Influence People, it would appear he disagrees with its core premise. Indeed, he seemed to be itching for a fight, including with his own shadow, during an at times tetchy tumult. We'll hear later in the programme from the Chief Minister, Health Minister and Treasury Minister, but first, former Health Minister Laurie Hooper, who resigned late last year, claiming Council of Ministers wouldn't give him the money he needed.
We get a new Health Minister in place. She comes to Tynwald with a motion that says, let's have the 15 million that you wanted, and then you vote against. Is that not a bit hypocritical?
So the reason that I resigned wasn't just because they wouldn't actually fund the service, it was because they had repeatedly lied about the fact they were properly funding the service, when we all know they weren't. So instead of actually funding the service from day one, which would have meant we could have made the changes that needed to be made, they didn't. They get to the end of the year, they panic, they're scraping around for extra funds, and then it turns out some of the other things they've decided to fund have pushed the deficit up even more. So the doctor's pay award, for example, we were repeatedly reassured that was going to be done within the existing budget, we wouldn't need any extra money, and it turns out actually that wasn't true. And the memorandum that we were shared with Tynwald quite clearly says some of the extra money was for that pay award. And even though it was in the memorandum, the minister still had the nerve to stand up and say, no, it hasn't affected this deficit position. Well, it clearly did. And actually, from my perspective, you cannot support a government that is just fundamentally dishonest.
I sort of get that point, but you felt that the 15 million was needed when you were minister. It does seem a little churlish maybe to vote against that now that you're not minister, because you clearly still believe that the money was needed.
Oh, absolutely, I believe the money was needed. The point I'm making is they should have been honest about that from day one. Instead, what they've done is they've enacted their plans to start pushing more and more people towards private care. So instead of taking that money and investing it in the public health service, what they're actually doing is, as we've seen, they're slashing services, they're extending waiting times, they're reducing elective surgeries. And even though they're doing all of those things, they're still saying they want more money. And actually, that doesn't stack up. They are just being dishonest with people about what they're doing. They are trying to pretend that we can carry on the way we are, that their decisions that they're making are not going to have real consequences for real people. And they're trying to plug the gap with these end-of-the-year supplementary votes. I mean, the fact is, they asked for 20 million quid to start off with. And it turns out that by forcing them to delay that by a couple of months, we save 5 million pounds. I mean, if they actually had a handle on what they were doing, you could probably save even more. And that's the issue I've got with this, really, is that basic level of dishonesty that we're dealing with. I just cannot believe anything they tell us anymore.
So, obviously, your successor has only been in place for 7 months. Are you saying that you have no confidence in her ability to turn this round?
I have zero confidence in her ability, not just to turn this round, but just generally. I think we have an incompetent administration that was being proven time and time again. We've just had a massive debate on the living wage where the government's own report contradicted some of the things the minister was telling Tynwald. This administration has just lost the plot completely.
Well, we'll come on to the living wage shortly, but I mean, you're talking there about slashing services, reducing, lengthening waiting lists. I mean, is that just wishful thinking on your part, or is that really happening?
That's what they explicitly said they were doing in their mandate and operating plan. That is explicitly their intention. The mandate says we are going to lengthen waiting times because we are going to slow down elective capacity. Manxcare's response to that was, do you not realise this will push up A&E wait times as well? That is all in those documents the government has published. That is their clearly stated intention. Now, the minister may not be aware of what's in her own documents, but that is exactly what they've proposed to Tynwald. That is exactly what they've instructed Manxcare to do.
I mean, this isn't just you jumped a bit too soon, perhaps, in terms of this whole thing when you were minister, and now that you recognise that, perhaps you're feeling a little out of sorts and looking at someone to blame.
No, I am still completely convinced that if I had stayed in post, the government would have continued to try and push more privatisation of services onto people, which is what we're seeing happen anyway. But I think the fact that I called that out publicly forced them to at least temporarily reconsider their position on things. Like I said, I can't stop it from happening. Tynwald seems to have bought into some of the narrative that the government is giving them, which I'm quite disappointed by. Actually, there isn't really any meaningful opposition coming from Tynwald at the moment, and that's the reality of the situation. But ultimately, and you'll see this this in some of the other debates that are coming up later on in this sitting. I'm very concerned that we don't have competent leadership at the moment.
Well, I'm sure that the leadership would suggest otherwise, but clearly that's for the public eventually to decide, possibly in about a year's time. One thing that you did after the debate on the minimum wage, that living wage link, was post a kind of a name and shame picture of the vote. So there were six people voted for Mr. Watterson's, Speaker Watterson's amendment. The other 18 members of the House of Keys voted against. You suggested that in some way they were, well, I don't know, maybe I'm putting words into your mouth, but I got the feeling that you felt that they were being a little heartless in the way they've approached this issue. Actually, listening to the debate, though, they were making points. They were, you know, I'm sure they believe they are reasonable points. It seemed like it was much more nuanced than the black and white picture that you were painting.
So most of them didn't actually speak in the debate, so let's put that one out there. But the vote was quite simple. Mr. Watterson's amendment was that the minimum wage on the Isle of Man should be based on the living wage. That was the amendment. And that is something I fundamentally believe. I think a living wage is something everyone should be able to earn. We should be saying wages should be fair on the island, and that means making sure people can, if they work a full week, afford to go home and pay the bills and put a roof over their head without needing to access the benefit system. That's the way it should be. The vote was very simple, and those members said, no, I don't believe that. I don't believe that members of the people on the Isle of Man should be entitled to what is described as a basic standard of living. That's what the living wage is talked about in the Living Wage Report, a basic standard of living. That's all we're asking for here. And 18 members of Timbal said, no, we disagree. We'd rather go down a different route that actually has no relation whatsoever to the cost of living. We think we should just arbitrarily decide that you should have a minimum wage that actually doesn't even meet that level that is required for a basic standard of living. That's where we've ended up, a minimum wage position that will be lower than a basic standard of living. It is, in fact, set at the level the OECD benchmarks at what they call a low-pay benchmark. So what we have on the Isle of Man now is a low-pay benchmark for the minimum wage. So we are now officially a low-pay island. That is exactly where the government has placed us. That is exactly the decision Timbald has taken. And if you said this is naming and shaming, these are public votes. Those MHKs are quite happy to go out to their constituents and say, yes, I do not believe that you deserve a living wage. I believe that you deserve a low-pay. If they want to make that case to their constituents, they are free to do so. That is something I fundamentally disagree with.
And yet, well, I'm sure they would all say, no Timbal member would go out to their constituents and say that they don't believe that people deserve a reasonable minimum wage.
Of course they wouldn't, and that's my point. That's because they're fundamentally dishonest. So they're not going to go out to their constituents and say, that was the vote on the table, and that's what I voted for. They're going to say, no, I didn't mean that. I support this. But you have to remember, here are all the mitigating factors that meant I couldn't really cast the vote in the way that I truly believe I should have cast my vote. That's the explanation you'll get. You won't get any of them standing up and honestly saying, no, I fully support my decision to not support a living wage on the island. I guarantee you that won't happen. They will all find excuses and explanations that justify to themselves why they are able to sell their constituents down the river.
And yet, the minimum wage that you were proposing based on the living wage, it isn't going to be that dissimilar to what Timbal's ultimately voted for.
This year? What about next year? Or the year after? What if cost of living continues to spiral? What if we have bigger problems? Doesn't take any of that stuff into account. And if you don't think that difference is huge, I mean, it works out at about 2%, I think, which is about 30 or 40 pence an hour. I would suggest you go and talk to people who are working on the minimum wage, for whom 30 or 40 pence an hour is a sizable amount of money when it boils down to it. I suspect if I went to the Minister for Enterprise and said, we're going to cut your budget by 2%, he wouldn't see that as an insubstantial difference. He would say that is unacceptable. We can't possibly have such a large cut to our budgets. But that's what Timbald is doing to people on the lowest wages. So 2% doesn't sound like a lot. And it maybe isn't a lot. If you're earning £100,000 a year, like most of the members of Timbald are on, 80 grand or whatever it is, but if you are working on those low wages, on the minimum wages, 2%, 30 pence an hour actually can be quite substantial.
And indeed it can, but it's still the minimum wage next year is going to be more than it was this year.
Yes, minimum wage has gone up, and I think this is part of the problem with the minister's argument. He was saying minimum wage has gone up by nearly 50% over the course of this administration, and yet at the same time he was saying, well, if we do this, it's going to result in mass unemployment on the island. But the evidence doesn't show that. Minimum wage has gone up quite a lot, and we haven't got mass unemployment. We haven't seen businesses collapsing across the piece because of this particular issue. And that's where none of this stacks up. The arguments they're making are not supported by their own report, they're not supported by the economic evidence, they're not supported by the evidence they had from their own consultants. In fact, this is a purely political decision being made because the government, I think, is afraid of what their chums in the Chamber of Commerce are telling them, rather than looking at the evidence that's in front of them.
Again, other places that have introduced significant increases to things like the minimum wage have included various support packages to help businesses, particularly those businesses involved in sectors that have lower pay. That's not happening in the Isle of Man, and there are businesses, particularly in the hospitality sector, that are going out of business. You don't think there's any link?
I absolutely think that the government should be supporting those businesses. When you look at Jersey, when they made the decision to move to a living wage, they actually introduced, I think it was a £20 million fund to help businesses transition. Our government flat out refused to do that. It was a question I asked them, and they said, no, our support schemes are perfectly adequate. When, as you and I both know, they're not. They don't cover most of our domestic economy, actually. They're not covered by those support schemes. And so, yes, the government absolutely should have put support in place, and that was always part of the intention. Transition to a living wage, provide support for those businesses that will need help in order to do that. And I think because the government failed to do that piece of work, because they have let those businesses down, they've now decided the right thing to do, instead of actually helping those businesses, is to also go and let down their workers. And so it is a failure on both sides for this government. They haven't supported businesses, they haven't supported workers, they are just a failure.
You referenced earlier in the interview the lack of leadership across government, that you basically feel that the government is failing in that regard. How would you, if you were in the position to provide that leadership, how would you go about bringing what is generally recognised, certainly from most of the Tynwald members that I speak to, as a split Tynwald, kind of an ideological split, a 50-50 split? How do you build bridges and bring people together?
Well, the starting point is being honest with each other. And I think this government is just incapable of doing that. They are fundamentally not capable of being honest with Tynwald members. And we've seen this in the debate around healthcare funding. We've seen this in the debate around the living wage. We've just had an element of that as well in the immigration debate. They tell you what they think they want to say, but actually it isn't backed up by facts. We've had ministers claiming that regulatory bodies have made certain statements when they haven't, but other ministers providing answers to Tynwald saying things have happened when they haven't, or things that haven't happened that have. All of this is on the record, publicly available information, and yet they get away with it. They are not challenged in any meaningful way by Tynwald members. They're not challenged in any meaningful way by the press. They are allowed to basically say whatever they like, and that's part of the problem, because when we know they are being dishonest, it is very hard to trust them. It's very hard to put faith in them when they then start telling us the things they are going to do next week. Well, actually, I know that you're not being honest with me about the things you're doing now, so why should I believe that you're going to do those things next week? And I think being honest with each other is the first step towards rebuilding some of that trust and rebuilding some of that cohesiveness that Tynwald needs in order to get things done. If I can't trust the minister when the minister makes a promise, well, that makes it difficult for me to vote for things the minister wants to do, because I don't trust them anymore. And I think that's where we're at. I think there is very little trust at the moment in aspects of our government, and I think that is making it very hard for them to get things done.
I mean, dishonest is a very strong word to bandy around in relation to your colleagues. I'm sure that they would say that no, they are being honest, and that they are trying their best to solve problems that currently exist. And I guess that by calling them dishonest, that's not building bridges and finding ways in which compromises and ways forward for the future of the island can be found.
No, but it is an honest assessment. And I think that's the problem. We're afraid to be honest with each other. You know, people are afraid to call out things that they see as problems. They're afraid to call out some of these behaviours. And actually, it's perfectly okay now. We had a standards debate quite recently where Tim Wall said it's absolutely fine to accuse other members of fabricating evidence to making false statements. That is perfectly legitimate parliamentary discourse now. And actually, fine. You know, if that's where we are, if we are now being encouraged almost by Tim Wall to call this stuff out, maybe we should be calling it out more openly and stop using kind of fancy parliamentary language and just start speaking in ways that everyone can understand. If I think ministers are making false statements or fabricating an evidence base, maybe I should just start saying it as it is. And actually, that's kind of the point of this, really, isn't it? It's to say, let's be honest with each other. If there are problems, the only way you can tackle them is if you first acknowledge the problems exist. There's no point pretending that they don't. And in terms of building bridges, trust me, I have been trying to do that for my entire time in Tim Wall Court, but we've reached the stage where, like I said, because I can't trust what I'm being told by ministers, ministers make promises they then don't follow through, promises which they then completely abandon. It is very hard to engage in any sort of constructive dialogue when you know full well the rug is going to be pulled out from under you, and whatever compromises you've agreed to in order to support their agenda, you know they're not going to hold up their side of the deal.
Do you think anyone could have accused you of being dishonest during your time as minister?
I'd hope not. I mean, to be fair, I was accused of that by the Chief Minister and by the Treasury Minister. They both told Tim Wall things. The Treasury Minister, for example, told Tim Wall that I had never raised the issue of Manx Care financial governance with Comin. I put an FY request asking for copies of all the minutes. 7 months later, they are still processing it because of the vast quantity of information that relates to those discussions. And so I have been accused of it, but ultimately, I would like to think that those accusations don't stack up, because I always try and be honest with people. And the problem you've got is when you're dealing with fundamentally dishonest people, are they going to make stuff up? Well, that's politics, you might say, but it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. We can be better than this.
Is there some of this? I mean, you're describing this as dishonest, but there's an inevitability that ministers can't give all the information that they know because of the nature of running governments. Is that the issue here?
No, I fully accept that, and I don't expect to always be told everything, especially not necessarily in public. No, when I use words like dishonest, what I mean is when ministers are telling Tim Wall things that are provably incorrect. That's what I'm getting at. And actually, after you then point that out to the minister, rather than them saying, actually, yeah, fair point, I didn't understand, they double down. They then go on the offensive and actually repeat some of those claims and statements and assertions they've made. I accept that we can't always know everything. We can't always be involved in everything. Sometimes there are things which you don't want to discuss publicly. I would never criticise ministers for trying to manage what I would see as the best interests of the island in that respect. But when they stand up in Tim Wall and they make statements that are provably just incorrect, and I think sometimes you go, maybe that was a mistake, maybe they don't understand it, but ministers habitually don't stand up and correct the record subsequently, that is dishonest.
That was Laurie Hooper. So is Chief Minister Alf Cannon dishonest?
Well, it's a bit rich coming from Laurie Hooper, who decided to pack in the health job because he couldn't stand the heat that simply was coming from the kitchen, and was the man who had been signed previous mandates to say that the Department of Health and Social Care was confident that Manx Care could operate in the budget that it had been allocated. You know, and in 2024, the year in which he decided to resign, in April, or in fact earlier, I think February or March, he had told Tim Wall and signed a mandate that clearly said the Department of Health and Social Care was confident that Manx Care could operate within the financial envelope that had been allocated to them. So I think it's very rich coming from Laurie Hooper, who seems to think everybody is imperfect and everybody is wrong except himself, and unless he's been specifically involved in that particular piece of legislation or the particular piece of policy.
Various points in the interview that we've just heard from Laurie Hooper, he makes that strong sort of comment that he believes ministers are dishonest. I mean, he says the same thing in relation to the minimum wage. The suggestion that he put out on social media following the minimum wage vote was that in some way anyone who hadn't supported the Speaker didn't support giving people a decent reasonable wage that they could live on. Is that true?
Well, frankly, I think Laurie Hooper's being ridiculous in his statements and you know, his allegations, you know, that people are being dishonest. It's just frankly not the case, Phil. You know that government at times can be incredibly difficult, that policy ambitions sometimes run into a bit of trouble for various reasons and not always deliverable, and that the perfect world is very, very hard to achieve. We've been ambitious. If we're guilty of one thing, it's been ambitious of trying to sort of deliver a hugely ambitious economic program to recover from COVID, to deal with all the demographic issues, to tackle the problems of the economic problems that have been facing us in so many different ways. You know, and things like, for example, living wages, where we have pushed up the minimum stroke living wage by almost 50% during the lifetime of this government. Determining how that is to be measured has proven very, very difficult. And in the end, we've determined that actually we will more fall in line with what is being done elsewhere and link that to median wages. So there will be a very specific measurement attached that, you know, we will utilize for the time being, and we'll continue to look at that and continue to evaluate it. And in fact, some members of Timor were arguing yesterday that they thought the median wage calculation would be more beneficial for those on low income than the living wage calculation. So it's not a perfect world, but ministers aren't being dishonest. They're just trying to do their best and make the most reasonable, sensible decisions that will help both those, in this case, on low wages in terms of helping them to drive up their living standards, but also do what we think is understandable, logical, and sensible, both for them, but also for the economy, and from, you know, from a sort of almost independent view, adopt a measurement that we can all actually understand.
Obviously, this is we're not even into election year yet. Are you expecting that more members will start making? Well, I don't know. On Laurie Hooper's side, he'll be suggesting that more ministers will be bending the truth. On the other side of the argument, people like Laurie will be being more outspoken and saying more outlandish things.
Well, I've already been clear with you, I think, in a recent interview, Phil. There are those of us that want to work and want to carry on working, and will continue to work and give absolutely every ounce of energy and commitment that we have to delivering on our commitments in the island plan and making the island, I hope, a better place in a number of ways, both economically and socially, and continuing to work at tackle the problems that don't just exist on the Isle of Man, but exist globally in so many different similar scenarios with many other countries, and tackling those problems and continuing to deliver. And if Laurie Hooper and others want to sit on the outside and throw rocks for the next 12 months on the basis that that's the foundation of their election campaign, they're absolutely welcome to it.
That was Alf Cannon. Is the government fundamentally dishonest? Health Minister Clare Christian.
His view was government is fundamentally dishonest in claiming that the health service is properly funded. He's kind of got a point, in as much as you've voted through in this month's Tynwald $15 million overspend.
Yes, I think it's important to remember that he has also, as the ex-minister, come forward with supplementary votes every year, Phil, when he was health minister. And even though he had to present that and with a mandate claiming that the DHSC believed that Manx Care would come in budget. So he knows more than anybody that actually that's the situation when you lay the mandate down with all the good intention in the world. He's come back several years and asked for a supplementary vote himself. And I wish he'd supported the supplementary vote. It's strange that there's a man here that's calling for more funding for the health service, but yet didn't support the additional funding.
But what he said was he fundamentally doesn't believe that government, I guess that means yourself because you're the health minister, are being honest about the funding needs of the health service.
So I think it's important to distinguish between a disagreement and dishonesty. So decisions in government are rarely, rarely simple, but they are made with transparency and integrity. So the ministerial code is quite clear about the need for honesty, and if he has any evidence that ministers have behaved dishonestly, then he should submit that evidence through the correct channels. Disagreement over policies is not dishonest. That's politics. So, in terms of the specific point that he made about the doctor's pay award, let's be very clear, and so that there's no confusion, the doctor's pay award was funded by the underspend within the DHSE for the year. Our approach to the pay award was transparent and consistent with the information outlined in the memorandum, and I stand by that statement I made at the time, and which were based on the best information available and in good faith.
I suppose what Laurie Hooper would rightly say to that is, well, how could it have been funded within the existing budget if you've had a 15 million overspend?
So you're right, you're absolutely right. I think, remember, this was his mandate that he brought, this overspend was for the year that he was majoritively as minister. It's a situation which I have picked up, obviously, in the last 7 months. That year ended in March. So absolutely, no one wants to be in that position where you're asking for a supplementary vote as a new minister. But as I said, he should know that this time last year, which I said earlier in my interview with you, Phil, this time last year, they were projecting 18 million as an overspend for the whole year. And this year we're looking at currently 1.2 just for the first 2 months.
So I suppose then what you're saying is when Laurie Hooper left, the overspend was looking like 18 million, you agreed the pay rise and you got the overspend down to 15 million. Is that pretty much the...
No, you're conflating two areas. So the 18 million was a predicted, so when they were sitting here this time last year, they were predicting an overspend, right, for an entire year. So when we came to Tim Wald with a supplementary vote for the 20 million, sorry, I know it's confusing a lot of numbers, for the 20 million, what Treasury and Manx Care and the department had done is we had estimated possible risks. So whilst we all could see absolutely we were sat at 15 million, there could have been some possible risks, so they were including that. That vote was up to 20 million, it was very clear. What happened was I explained it earlier, we were asked by Tynwald to wait till all the finances actually, end of year came in, to have a real final figure of how much we were going to be overspent. And that's a lot of those risks didn't transpire, and that's the point. And those risks could have been winter pressures, those risks could have been drug costs, that could have been elsewhere. So that's a good thing. Those risks didn't transpire. There was no dishonesty in that, and there was no trying to hide anything from that.
The other suggestion then that Laurie Hooper made was that actually the way that you've managed to find budgets to pay for the doctor's pay award is by effectively increasing waiting lists and encouraging people to go private.
So, I'm familiar with. He mentioned obviously that he thought that I didn't know what was in my own documents. But I refute that. I'm very familiar with what's in both the mandate and the operating plan. But I think it's important not to mischaracterise strategic planning as simple cutting services. So what that means is the intention is to protect core services and not to undermine them. So it's about making the system sustainable so we can protect the core people and rely on it. You know, I feel like one of the areas that he said was that obviously A&E waiting times were increasing, and there is public information that, and I'm looking at that now, he's sitting here with you, Phil, the average time between arrival and triage at Nobles Hospital Emergency Department in April 24 was 25 minutes, in April 25 it was 25 minutes, in May 24 it was 31 minutes, in May 25 it was 25 minutes. I can give you another, and I think it's important to give data because that's facts. You know, I don't think Mr. Hooper can, can contest those facts. So the percentage of emergency department attendees where the service user was admitted, transferred, or discharged within 4 hours of their arrival, in April 2024 it was 67.9%, and in April 25 it was 64.7%. In May 24, 66.5%, and in May 25, 70.3%. So it was a small rise there. But you know, we are managing this and we are monitoring this. So I would hope that Mr. Hooper would perhaps, before he made some claims, would actually look at the evidence.
And effectively, those differences are negligible. So the best that Mr. Hooper could, I guess, claim is that there hasn't been a substantial decrease in waiting times or in numbers of people being treated.
No, I think that's that. You're absolutely right there, Phil. And I think it's really important to know that this. You know, when I mean, I've said this before. I've gone into the A&E department, and I have seen how hard the consultants and the staff and the nurses, everybody, are working there. And while these statistics are really important to look at, you know, that 4 hour, because that's a standard that is an international standard. However, I was reassured by those consultants that actually discharging someone after 4 hours, they're not concentrating on, what they're concentrating on is making sure that that person gets the right care. And if they need them to stay for 6 hours because they need, I believe, and I have to get this right, but if somebody has a suspected stroke, I believe you need a 4 hour difference between taking the first set of blood tests and the second set of blood tests. So, of course, that's important. They're not going to just discharge you for the 4 hours, and that's a lot of what's happening in other trusts in the UK, where it's a statistic that they're trying to hit. But actually, these people care. The people that work there really, really care about patients.
And finally, former Minister Hooper has no confidence in you as minister, and believes that every minister is dishonest.
So it is really disappointing that he clearly believes that making inflammatory and personal attacks is any way helpful or achieves any possible outcome. Phil, my focus continues to be firmly on the future and the work ahead.
I mean, you say all that, but basically what Mr. Hooper is saying is that he cannot support a government that is fundamentally dishonest. I mean, are you? Your government, this council of ministers, fundamentally dishonest.
Yeah, I mean, these are quite personal remarks. The chief minister's already responded to that, and I take my responsibilities to Tynwald extremely seriously. And I've, you know, never knowingly been dishonest, and nor would I ever do so. But if Mr. Hooper says he cannot support this government because he believes it's fundamentally dishonest, then I'm bemused as to why he is still in both in his positions within the DOI and DEFA, I wonder why he hasn't resigned from both of those positions if he truly believes that.
That was Health Minister Claire Christian. Finally, Treasury Minister Alex Allanson.
Some Tynwald colleagues of yours have suggested, following the vote, that the majority of Tynwald was against having a reasonable minimum wage or linking the minimum wage with the living wage. How would you respond to that?
I can understand their frustration. I think all of us have found that we made an absolute commitment to merge the minimum wage with the living wage back in 2021 after the Poverty Committee reported. But as we've got closer and closer to that time to do it, i.e. now, it's become far more complicated. And we've got now a living wage report that was published only recently, which says that some of their calculations just don't quite work, and they can't look at the minimum income standards anymore. They need to do something different. So I think what we've done is taking a pragmatic approach to introduce a proportion of the median earnings going forward, so that in October we will announce what will be, in effect, the minimum living wage to come in the following April. That will give certainty to employees and employers, and hopefully create a new sense of purpose in terms of increasing the median earnings right across our country, which is one of the key parts of the Ireland Plan. But it has got far more complicated. What looked like being something being quite simple back in 2021 has obviously been overtaken by a whole range of aspects in terms of increased prices, increased particularly in housing prices as well. And so we're responding to that, but also trying to absolutely ensure that people who work on the Isle of Man get a decent wage so they can enjoy living on the Isle of Man.
And I guess that's where the other side of this debate comes in. I mean, the very reasonable suggestion, I thought, that Mr. Speaker, I think, made most forcefully was that actually basing your living wage or minimum wage on how many people get paid various different amounts of money isn't as relevant as basing it on how much it actually costs people to live on the island. The suggestion, certainly from that side of the argument, is that minimum wage and living wage is a calculation that's made just the same as median wage is made. So it's not really that complicated.
The issue with the living wage is it's based on all sorts of different households, whether you've got children, whether you haven't, whether you're retired, whether you're not. And then it's all amalgamated with weightings to come up with an hourly rate, which is meant to suit everyone. So it's not ideal. What we do know, though, is that by linking the minimum wage, living wage, to median earnings, we will get a lot more stability, we'll get a lot more certainty. And at a time at the moment in terms of our economy, I think that's what we need. What we will have is not some of the sudden swings we've had in terms of minimum wage, living wage in the past. Remember, during COVID, the minimum wage didn't go up at all for 2 years. And actually, that wasn't that was a good idea at the time, but has had legacy issues now. So by linking it to median earnings, I think we'll have a lot more stability. And hopefully we can then grow the economy for the benefit of everyone.
So are they wrong in saying it's not complicated to calculate the living wage?
It is complicated to calculate the living wage. The basket of goods changes. We peg the way we process the living wage with how it's done across, but with minor differences in terms of housing. For instance, single people and couples without children are judged to be in private rental, but anyone with children are judged to be in social housing. Well, that's not always the case. There is some increases attributed to the cost of getting on and off the island, but otherwise we follow very much the UK process. And in the UK and here this year, they found that there was a significant increase in their calculations, and they're looking at it again. So I think from a pragmatic point of view, actually Tim Wald have decided, okay, let's go with something we're far more certain about in terms of median earnings, go for a process we are far more certain we can deliver in terms of announcing something in October, implementing it in April the next year, and move forward. But obviously all of these processes will be under future review.
And your colleagues, who effectively seem to have been whipping up the masses in relation to all this and suggesting that those who didn't support Mr. Speaker's amendment to actually base the minimum wage on the living wage, as had been the original intention of Tim, well, the suggestion is in some way that those who voted against were heartless skinflints and only interested in the rich people and not the poor.
Yeah, I'm disappointed, to be honest with you, that we couldn't rely upon the calculations of the living wage to deliver what Tim Wald wanted, because of that uncertainty, because of the way the calculation has been done, particularly this year, and also because of the effects that might have on the economy, particularly in those parts of the economy, such as the hospitality sector, which are struggling at the moment. I think what we've done, though, is come up with a far more pragmatic way of making sure that people on low income get a decent pay increase year on year and know about it in advance, and that their employers also know about it in advance and can factor that in. But again, you know, Tim Wald will look at these in the future. We'll look at what happens on the adjacent isles. We need to remain competitive in terms of keeping people who are here already here, and also attracting people to come and join us. And this will be an ongoing process.
Well, a couple of other motions then. The yes, the one that we've been recently discussing in Tynwald, we're obviously recording this during the Tynwald sitting, was the inward migration discussion. It seemed that we had quite a long debate on relatively anodyne, non-controversial report and recommendations.
I actually think immigration has become really quite a toxic debate on the adjacent aisle. And I think similarly, people on the Isle of Man are concerned about what they see on the news and what they see on the TV, and worry that might come to our island as well. And in some ways, the Manx way of life and the society that we've got might in some way be damaged. What we've done in terms of government and Tynwald is make quite clear that we want to respect people who live on the island. We want to make sure that the people who are here have the right skills and the ability to get jobs and have a decent standard of living in terms of things like the living wage as well and the minimum wage. But also that the Isle of Man has always welcomed people to join us wherever they're from, whether that's people from the Northern Hemisphere in terms of the Vikings in the past, or the Southern Hemisphere with the immigration we had in the past from Italy and Spain, or from further afield, from South Africa, from Southeast Asia, from Australia. And we're seeing a real diversification in terms of our society, but that's mirrored in lots of other places. What a lot of the debate was about was welcoming people who can come to our island, who can enrich our society, who can embrace our culture and actually add to our economy. But to do that in an organised way so that we also look after some of the things we hold dear, make sure we've got the infrastructure to welcome them, make sure that those people who are joining us benefit from being on the island, but not to the detriment of those people already here. And I think the way that the government are planning to go forward over the next couple of years with a whole range of policies and strategies is the right thing to do.
And of course there is a fine balance, I guess, between, on the one hand, protecting the island from people that we don't want coming over to the island, but also, on the other hand, we actually do want people coming into the island, or at least the Isle of Man government wants people coming into the island to live and work.
Yes, I mean, what the debate was talking about was people coming over here to take part in our economy, take part in our society. When you look at the figures, amongst the largest numbers of people who are invited to come to our island are working in the care sector, in our health service. They're teachers. They're those people who take several years to gather their skills and be trained. Yes, we are training people on the island already. We're training GPs, nurses, secondary school teachers now as well, but we still need to get people who have those skills. Part of the report was also trying to welcome back those people, the great Manx diaspora, all around the world, and welcome some of those people back to the island and encourage them to come and rejoin their relatives. And so it is a part of a wider debate. But also people talked about border security, which is obviously one of the key points of the reset of the island plan, because in a very uncertain world we need to be absolutely sure that we can protect our island and our island's integrity and our population. Sometimes they're conflated. What we're talking about, though, is about migration and people coming over here to live and work. But it did go wider into sort of border security, border controls, to keep track of who's coming and going, partly because that then influences some of the further debates we're going to be having in July Tynwald about the Chief Constable's report and organised crime coming over here and how we can guarantee the safety for all our society.
And then the final point, it was the £15 million overspend for the health department, which finally got through Tynwald. There was a suggestion made to this programme that if the vote had gone against that £15 million, Treasury would have found a way to sort this out. Is that the case?
Well, Treasury and Tynwald are in a slightly strange situation, because normally the supplementary bids come before the money's been spent. That a department will say, look, we're heading for an overrun. Would Tynwald mind changing the budget that you decided earlier on in the year? And the minister did bring a motion to march Timwell, but Timwell decided not to vote on it and to come back when you had the full figure. Now, of course, we're now in July. That money's been spent. It's the previous year. And they overspent by 15.3 million. They've given the exact figure, and that was approved. What we're desperately trying to do is get the right financial management in a very difficult situation with healthcare globally, in terms of increasing costs, increasing wages, increasing need for treatments, and increasing costs, particularly for tertiary referrals to the UK. So government are working very closely through the Department of Health and Social Care, their interaction with Manx Care, the right financial support as well, and a review of the governance between the two. There were several people who spoke about how intolerable it was to have an overspend, and those people who've been in Timwell for slightly longer, such as the speaker, said that I've been through this many times before. There always needs to be some slack in the system, which is why this financial year we've brought in a £10 million contingency to deal with some of these overspends, hopefully, but also why Treasury are working with the department to meet Manx Care on a regular basis and make sure they can continue to provide the frontline services, but within the budget that's been allocated to them by Timwell.
The 1.2 million reported overspend of the first 2 months must be a concern, but I guess would that be covered by the 10 million contingency, assuming, of course, that they can't peg that back during the rest of the year?
Well, that's one of the issues. All departments are given a budget to work on. The contingencies are there for things that are unforeseen, rather than just to make the figures add up within the first quarter of any financial year. So the Manx Care Board have announced that they've got an overspend at the moment. We will be looking to see how they can start cutting that back. They've identified it early. How can you try to bring yourself back on track? And really, a contingency there is for unexpected costs, particularly, you know, some of the really expensive drugs cost hundreds of thousands of pounds. Some of the expensive treatments are similarly cost a huge amount of money just for one person. That's the right thing to do for that person, but it should be budgeted for. And again, sometimes we have winter pressures. We know when winter is coming, so we need to make the right plans now to deal with those pressures over the coming months.
We also know when TT is coming. We also know when the Manx Grand Prix, or whatever it's now called, is coming, and the Southern 100 and all the other motor races that take place in the island. There was an impassioned contribution by Tim Glover in relation to this, that in some way this was now being highlighted as an additional cost to the department. In relation to the whole way in which government looks at the TT, should it be much more clear the actual costs associated with running these events, as well as the advantages, the economic advantages, because of course health is one, but DOI of course is the other. DOI effectively is maintaining a race course,
and the chief constable would also say that his staff under extreme pressure during TT, the fire brigade, the ambulance service. It does increase the work that government right across the piece have to do. But on the other hand, it's a huge benefit to the Isle of Man. In the last administration, the Cabinet Office undertook an economic impact assessment of the TT and the Manx Grand Prix, looking at both the cost but also the economic benefit that they gave. And what they showed was that with so many tourists coming over here, it allowed those businesses, particularly in the hospitality sector, to make enough during the good months to see them through some of the less good months, through the winter. And so that's why we have some really nice restaurants and bars and pubs here on the island, possibly far more than you get if we were a small provincial English town. And that's the benefit, as well as it's part of our cultural identity. The great joy of being on the Isle of Man is we can do things differently. And road racing is one of those, whether that's on motorbikes, in cars, or even on bicycles, because we've got the Grand Fondo coming up this week. And again, that will attract people from all over the world to come and cycle on our roads and actually appreciate what we have here on our island.
So what is the kind of the net benefit or cost, perhaps, of the TT then?
The last time we calculated it was pre-COVID, so now the benefit will be far better, far more. And some of it is intangible. We know that the TTX is a huge marketplace for what the Isle of Man can offer. We know that people have come over here for the TT and stay and make this their home. And it is an intrinsic part of our new culture and our new attitude to how we do things differently on the island. So at a time when budgets are tight, I can completely appreciate why the police, the health service might say, well, hang on a minute, you know, this is costing us money. Why the DOI may say, well, making sure a racetrack is fit to race on isn't really part of our work. We'd rather do all the potholes in residential areas. It's getting that balance right and appreciating what we have and really marketing it and relishing it.
And of course, the thing that the DOI can do, but the health department can't so readily, is stop doing stuff. So if towards the end of the year the DOI looks as though it's running out of money, it can cancel some schemes or postpone schemes to the next financial year. It's more difficult to do that when it comes going back to health, to the health department, cancelling operations and reducing services in terms of the health department is a bigger deal.
Well, but it is, but actually what's been happening over a number of years is during the TT period, to make sure there is capacity in terms of the operating theatres, in terms of accident emergency and intensive care, often some of the elective surgery is paused for those few weeks to give that extra capacity. We also have people coming over to join the team at Nobles. Paramedics come over again from all over the world to help with the running of the TT. And we can't forget the marshals. I mean, the TT would not be able to function without so many local people and friends from across volunteering to run the greatest road races in the world.
And that was Treasury Minister Alex Allenson. So what do you think? Is Lawrie Hooper absolutely right in claiming government is fundamentally dishonest? Does this sort of rhetoric help deliver the improved services we all need? I'm Phil Gorn. Go to myosengage.com. Thanks for listening.